Chapter 15. Two bells into the morning of our 45th day, the storm struck.
All hands, all hands.
Even as the cry came, the Seahawk pitched and yawed violently. Whether I got out of my hammock on my own, or was tossed by the wrenching motion of the ship, to this day I do not know. But I woke to find myself sprawling on the floor, the curtain torn asunder, the forecastle in wildest confusion. Above my head, the lantern swung grotesquely. The men's possessions skittered about like billiard balls. Trunks rolled helter-skelter. The watch was scrambling up. As the ship plunged and plunged again, the cry, "All hands! All hands!" came repeatedly, more urgent than I'd ever heard it. "Hurricane!" I heard as well. There was a frantic dash out of the forecastle into the deck. I followed too, trying to pull on my jacket as I ran against the violent pitching of the ship. Though long past dawn, the sky was still dark. A heavy rain, flung wildly by wind that screamed and moaned like an army in mortal agony, beat upon the deck in rhythms only a mad drummer could concoct. The sea hurled towering wall upon towering wall of foaming fury over us. One such tossed me like some drop of dew across the deck, where I, fortunately, crashed against a wall. As I lay stunned and bruised, gasping for breath, I caught sight of Mr. Hollybrass and Captain Jaggery in the midst of a furious dispute.
"No profit to be found at the bottom of the sea!" I heard the first mate cry above the storm. "Mr. Hollybrass, we sail through!"
the captain returned, breaking away to shout,
"All hands aloft! All hands aloft!"
I could hardly believe my ears, to go up into the rigging in this. But when I looked skyward, I could see the reason why. Under the brutal force of the wind, many of the sails had pulled free from their running ropes and were now tearing and snapping out of control, pulling themselves into wild whips.
"All hands aloft! All hands aloft!"
came the cry again. It was pleading, desperate. I could see the men, bent far over to buck wind and rain, struggling toward the shrouds. I pulled myself to my feet, only to be knocked down by still another wave. Again I staggered up, grasping a rope, managing to hold on with the strength of my two hands. Now I was able to stand, but just barely. Slowly I made my way toward the forward mast. When I reached it, it seemed to take forever, Captain Jaggery was already there, trying frantically to lash down ropes and rigging. "What shall I do?" I shouted to his back. Shouting was the only way I could make myself heard.
"Cut away the foreyard before it pulls the mast down,"
he yelled back. I'm not certain he realized it was me.
"Do you have a knife?"
he called.
"No!"
Even as he reached into a back pocket, he turned. When he saw it was me, he hesitated.
"A knife!"
I cried. He handed one to me.
"Where?"
I called.
"Didn't you hear me?"
he cried, gesticulating wildly.
"Cut that sail away."
I looked up. I could not see far into the sheets of rain. The Seahawk's wild pitching had set the mast to shaking as if it had the palsy. Only the foreyard was visible, and the sail was blowing from it almost into the shape of a balloon. Suddenly the sail collapsed into itself, then filled again. It would burst soon, or fly off with the mast.
"Up, damn you! Up, hurry!"
Captain Jaggery screamed. I reached into the rigging, but stopped, realizing I couldn't climb and hold the knife. With the blade between my teeth, I again grasped the rigging, and using both hands I began to climb. Though I was in fact climbing into the air, I felt as though I were swimming against a rising river tide. But more than rain or waves, it was the screaming wind that tore at me. I could hardly make out where I was going. To make matters worse, my wet and heavy hair, like a horse's tail, kept whipping across my face. I might have been blindfolded. Desperate, I wrapped my legs and one arm about the ropes. With my one free arm, I pulled my hair around, grasped it with the hand entwined in the ropes, and pulled it taut. I took the knife and hacked. With a shake of my head, my 13 years' growth of hair fell away. Feeling much lighter, I bit down onto the blade again and once more began to climb. Every upward inch was a struggle, as though I were forcing myself between the fingers of God's angry fist. And it was not just the elements that attacked. Below me, when I dared to look, the deck blurred into a confusing mass of water, foam, decking, and now and again a struggling man. I was certain the Seahawk would flounder, that we were doomed to drown. I told myself not to look, to concentrate on what I had to do. Up I went. The rain hissed. Thunder boomed. Lightning cracked. Human cries came too, shouts that rose up through the maelstrom, words I couldn't catch. But what they betokened was terror. As I crept further up the mast, the sail billowed out and away from me. The next moment the wind shifted and the great canvas collapsed, smashing its full wet weight against me, as though with a conscious mind to knock me from the rigging. Desperately I clung to the ropes with legs and arms. Then out the sail snapped. The ensuing vacuum all but sucked me off. God knows how, but I held on and continued up. I heard, threaded through the wailing wind, a ghastly shrieking sound. Then a tremendous splintering of wood. Could it, I wondered, be my mast? Was I about to be hurled into the waves? I dared not stop and think, but the mast held. Hand over hand, foot after foot, I struggled upward. I was certain we were all about to die. Whether above the waves or beneath them, it hardly seemed to matter. All I wanted was to reach that sail, as if by doing so I could rise above the chaos. To cut that sail free was my only purpose. I would not, could not, think of anything else. Sometimes I paused just to hang on, to gasp for breath, to remind myself I lived. But then, once again, I continued up. It felt like hours. It probably took minutes. At last I reached my goal. The Foreyard is one of the biggest sails, one of a sailing ship's true engines. But even though it worked hard for the ship under normal circumstances, in this storm it strained against her, as if trying to uproot the mast from the deck. Despite the roaring wind that beat about me, I could hear the creaking of the mast, could see it bend like a great bow. What I needed to do, had to do, was cut that sail free and release the terrible strain upon the mast. Fearful of wasting any time, I simply straddled the spar to which the sail's top edge was lashed and backed out toward its end, hacking away at each piece of rope as I came upon it. Fortunately, the lines were so taut and the blade so sharp, I hardly had to cut. The moment I touched a rope with the knife's edge, strands flew apart as if exploding. With each rope I cut, the sail blew out more freely, flapping in such frenzy it began to shred into tiny strands that I could no longer distinguish from the streaking rain. Bit by bit I moved along, cutting as I went, until I reached the spar's furthest end. There I had to make another decision. Should I cut the lines that held the spar itself? What would happen if I did so? If I did not? I looked about in the vain hope that another of the crew might be near. To my surprise, I did see the shadowy form of someone above, but who he was I couldn't tell. In any case, he was climbing farther up the mast than I. I decided not to cut more lines. Someone else could do so if that's what needed to be done. My job was to cut away the rest of the sail, which meant going back the way I'd come, and proceeding out along the spar toward the opposite end. The spar, however, with its lopsided weight, and me at one end, was swinging and lurching about so wildly I feared it might break free and drop with me on it. I had to get back to the mast. But the foot ropes were gone. In my wild hacking, I'd cut them free too. I would have to drag myself along. With the knife again clamped between my teeth, arms tightly locked around the spar, I flung myself down and tried to slide forward. But at the next lurch of the spar, my legs slipped away. The knife fell from my mouth. In a small part of a second, I was now dangling, legs down, facing away from the mast, about to drop into the wildest scene imaginable. I had no choice. I now had to clamber, hand over hand and backward, toward the mast. But as much as I tried for speed, I could move only in tiny increments. The wind and rain, as well as the tossing motion of the ship, kept impeding me. I was dangling in the hurricane winds, twisting. Over my shoulder, I could see that the mast was not far out of reach, but then my arms began to cramp. "Help!" I screamed. "Help me!" One hand lost its grip. 4 feet from the mast, I tried to swing myself back in the vain hope of grasping the mast with my legs. The attempt only weakened my hold more. I was certain I was going to drop. "Help!" I screamed into the wind. Suddenly, a figure appeared on the spar.
"Charlotte," I heard, "take my hand."
And indeed, a hand was thrust toward my face. I reached for it frantically, grabbed it, clung to it as it clung to me, its fingers encircling my wrist in an iron grip. For a moment, I was hanging by that one hand. Then I was yanked upward onto the spar so I could get my legs around it and locked. Gasping for breath, I glanced up at the figure who was now scrambling away. It was Zachariah. For one brief moment, I was certain I had died, and he was an angel. But I hardly had time for thought, for just above me I heard a great wrenching explosion. I looked up to see that the foreyard had ripped away. As the sail spun off in the wind, I caught a glimpse of its gray mass twisting and turning into oblivion like a tormented soul cast down to hell. I spun back around. The man I thought to be Zachariah had vanished. But even as I gazed in wonder, the Seahawk, free from the sail's pull and weight, heeled violently. To my horror, I saw the ocean rush up toward me. We were capsizing. But then suddenly, the ship shivered and righted herself. Gasping for breath, I clawed my way forward until I reached the mast, which I hugged as though it were life itself. Without the knife, there was nothing more I could do aloft. In any case, the sail I had been sent to free was gone. I began to descend, slipping more than I climbed. I jumped the last few feet onto the deck. I don't know if the storm had somewhat abated, or I'd just grown used to it. There were still strong winds, and the rain beat upon us as before, but the fury of the hurricane somehow softened. I looked about. Spars, some entangled with sails, lay in heaps. Railings were splintered. Dangling ropes flapped about. Then I saw some of the men on the quarterdeck working frantically with axes. I hurried to join them. Only then did I realize the mainmast was gone. All that remained was a jagged stump. I thought of the shriek I'd heard. Looking toward the stern, I saw Fisk slumped over the wheel. His great arms were spread wide, his hands clutching the wheel spokes. He could not have stayed upright had he not been lashed into place. I joined the men. Beneath the continual, if now somewhat slackened downpour, we all pulled at the great mound of downed spars and sails. Those that were dragging overboard, we cut loose and let go. Those we could move, we flung into the waist. And then, quite suddenly, as if heaven itself had triumphed over darkness, the rain ceased. The sea subsided into a roiling calm. Even the sun began to shine. And when I looked up, I saw, to my astonishment, a blue sky. "It's over," I said breathlessly. Mr. Johnson shook his head.
"Nothing like," he warned. "It's the eye of the storm. There'll only be a pause, and it'll be back in 20 minutes going the other way. But, God willing, if we can clear the deck, we may be able to ride it out."
I looked up at our remaining mast. Only the topgallant was left. The other sails had been cut loose. Working frantically, we reached the bottom of the pile. It was Foley who pulled away the last torn sail. There, beneath it, lay Mr. Hollybrass, face down. A knife was stuck in his back, plunged so deeply only the scrimshaw handle could be seen. I recognized the design of a star. This was the dirk Zachariah had given me. The sight of the dead Mr. Hollybrass, for it was certain that such was the case, left us all dumbfounded. But after all we'd been through in the storm, it's hardly to be wondered that we made no response. We were too drained, too numb.
"What is it?" came a voice.
We turned to see Captain Jaggery. He was looking much like the rest of us, wild and disheveled. We stepped aside. No one said a word. He came forward. For a moment, he too did nothing but stare at the body. Then he knelt and touched the man's face, the back of his neck. For a moment he hesitated, then pulled Mr. Hollybrass's arm from where it lay twisted under his body. The dead man clutched something in his hand. The captain managed to pry the fingers open and plucked away what Mr. Hollybrass had been holding. He held it up. It was my handkerchief. The captain now used that handkerchief to grasp the handle of the knife and pull it from the dead man's back. He stood up. He was looking directly at me. At last he turned toward the sky. It was darkening again, and the sea had begun to heave in growing swells.
"We shall have 15 more minutes before the storm returns," he announced. "I want this body removed and placed in the steerage. In the available time, the rest of you clear the deck. Mr. Johnson's watch shall man the pumps first. 2 from Mr. Hollybrass's watch will hold the wheel, and the rest can stay in the forecastle. I will call the rotation. Now, quickly!"
The captain's orders were carried out in silence. Dillingham and Grimes took Mr. Hollybrass's body below. The rest of us roamed the decks alone or in pairs, flinging broken bits of mast, sail, and spar into the sea, or trying to tie down what was possible to save by lashing it on deck. I followed along, doing what I could, my mind a jumble. Not a word was spoken regarding Mr. Hollybrass or his death. As extraordinary as the event was, there was no time, no mind to consider it. As predicted, the storm struck within the quarter hour, and with as much fury as before. But the Seahawk, with one mast and but a single sail hung, was more fit to ride it out. I rushed to the top cargo where the pumps were. They were simple suction pumps, each capable of being worked by as few as 2. But 4 we were, Grimes, Keach, Mr. Johnson, and myself, who heaved the handles in the cold, wet, and lurching darkness, as though our lives depended upon it, which they did. Again the Seahawk became a mere toy to the elements. Wind shrieked and howled. More than once water poured over us from above, or the ship heeled to the gunwales, bringing hearts to mouths. For the merest second, we would balance on the brink of capsizing while we pumped with greater will than ever. It was as if that rhythmic action was the true beating of our own hearts, as if, were we to stop for more than a moment, the heart of the ship might cease all beating too. To work meant to live, and work we did for upwards of 3 hours. Then we were released. I was sent to the forecastle to rest, along with Morgan, Barlow, and Fisk. Morgan searched for his tobacco pouch, but most personal belongings were flung about and broken, and those still whole were soaking wet. He swore in frustration.
"Be glad you're breathing air, lad," Fisk said wearily.
Chilled to the bone, exhausted, I tumbled into a hammock and tried to sleep. But I'd hardly closed my eyes before I was called out again. Now I was to stand to the wheel. The captain was there. To his credit, he remained at the helm throughout the storm, calling upon us to attempt this adjustment or that, anything to keep our stern toward the wind. Barlow, my partner, did most of the work. Great strength was wanted just to hold the wheel steady. Whatever strength I had was fast ebbing. I was frozen, miserable. It did not matter. From duty at the wheel, I returned to the pumps. From the pumps to the forecastle. Thence again to the wheel. Round and again, perhaps 3 times in all, I lost count. At last, some 17 hours after we'd first been called out, the storm abated. I was allowed to return to my hammock, where, spent and shivering, I closed my eyes. On the edge of sleep, I suddenly recalled the visitation of Zachariah and the demise of Mr. Hollybrass. This thought of the dead served to remind me that I was still alive, and that consolation eased my body and calmed my mind. Within seconds, I slept the sleep of the dead, who wait, with perfect equanimity, upon the final judgment.
This ends Disc 4.